It's 6 minutes after nine. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. Well, school funding seems to be a universal problem in the United States. Everyone wants to provide the best K-12 education we can for our children, but the agreement pretty much stops there. My guest this hour argues that states should emphasize district-level financing to improve the overall allocation of funding and maximize academic success. Joining me by phone this morning is R. Anthony Roll, Associate Professor at the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University. He is the author of a report just released by the Great Lakes Center for Research and Practice titled Strengthening the Link Between Effective School Expenditures and State Funding Mechanisms. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What prompted you to undertake this particular work of research?
I've been conducting school finance research since the early 1990s, and through a discussion at one of the regional meetings which I attend, the subject came up of what is the relationship between school funding mechanisms and student achievement or student performance. And this particular piece arose out of that conversation.
So when you looked at that question, what's the connection between school funding mechanisms and achievement, what did you find?
That's actually a pretty simple question with a very long answer.
Well, we've got an hour, so go ahead.
What you tend to find with state funding mechanisms is that states bound by Constitution and other legislation are slowly funding their schools through a continuously elongated state funding mechanism, meaning at one point, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, the state funding mechanism may have been fairly simple as funding mechanisms go. But as various political groups have enjoined in the political process to share their concerns with state legislators, the basic state funding mechanism has had pieces added to it. As these pieces get added to it, these pieces are added not in a way that may be directly related to education, but that may be added based on a political process or a political compromise.
So you're saying then that state legislatures make decisions sometimes based on political expediency? I'm shocked.
That is absolutely what I'm saying. But this is not an indictment of any legislator or any politician. It's really just a recognition of the process that exists. And if desired changes or improvements are to be made in education, folks who really believe in public education need to enjoin the process at every level, state, local district, as well as in their home communities.
We have 50 states in the United States, and plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and we spend $500 billion each year on K-12 education. Is there a constant in terms of when you looked at this at the various states? Is there some thread? I think I see one a little bit here from what you've already said, but was there some thread that went through everywhere? I know some states use property tax, like Wisconsin. The property tax is the basis of school funding. Other states have other resources and may not even have a property tax. But was there is there one constant thread that runs through all the states?
Yes, there is, actually. Despite the complexity of state funding mechanisms, the basic state funding mechanism really tries to equalize expenditures across districts, and that's true in every state. And what this equalization process means is that state legislatures decide what the minimum amount should be spent for each child. They use a variety of taxes to raise revenue. Some districts are high-revenue districts. Some districts are low-revenue districts. And in an attempt to equalize these differences, then the state contributes in inverse proportion to revenue generation ability or taxing ability. A simple way to explain it is if you're looking at kids in the playground, and you have two children sitting on a teeter-totter or a seesaw. There's a heavy kid on one side. There's a kid that's not so heavy on the other side. We can consider those two kids local revenues, however generated. But in order to balance those two kids out, you may have to add certain amount of weight to the lighter-sided kid until the seesaw is level. And that's what these state funding mechanisms are trying to do.
Well, in Wisconsin, it doesn't work quite that way. There's a uniformity clause in the state constitution referring to how property taxes are levied, and that means you can't give special tax property tax breaks to one group over another. But more importantly, the way that our system is set up, the wealthier school districts get to spend a lot more money per student than the school districts who don't have a lot of money. So that would be a difference there, just speaking for our Wisconsin listeners. But let's go. I want to go back to this. You know, we spend $500 billion every year, and we don't always get the outcomes we're looking for in terms of student achievement. So I want to get at the question of why that is. I mean, we spend all this money, and we still don't seem to be getting what we necessarily want, despite the heroic efforts of teachers and parents and so forth to get the best out of their school systems. We still aren't getting the results we want. Why is that?
Now, that's a much harder question, and if I had one answer to that, I'd be a very rich man. You have to realize that education policy alone will not generate the results you want. The best intended legislation, supported by the best intended legislators, supported by the best intended education system, from superintendent down to the classroom, even if all those are aligned and working optimally, the assumption then becomes that every student is going to also work optimally to achieve some level of education. And as we all know, as we look around the classrooms, this is not an indictment on students either, but students have different abilities, students have multiple learning styles, students have multiple goals, and students come from multiple situations. All these variations in the process are what is causing some of the differences in educational outcomes. What we can do as educators and politicians and researchers is to make sure that the resources available and the policies set in place are aligned as closely as possible with the multiple educational goals that we are desiring.
800-486-8655 is the toll-free number for listeners to join our discussion. We're talking about the relationship between school funding and achievement, and we'll be discussing some ideas of how to do a better job of funding schools so that we encourage high achievement. 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's a local call for you. Please use our local number, 227-2050, 227-2050. And you can also send us an email. Our address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this morning is R. Anthony Roll, Associate Professor at the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University. And he is the author of a report just released by the Great Lakes Center for Research and Practice titled Strengthening the Link Between Effective School Expenditures and State Funding Mechanisms. And he is here to answer your questions and mine, and we'll carry on the discussion here. One of the things that intrigued me about your report is, there's a fundamental assertion that you're making that when we look at how we fund schools and how we apportion money between various school districts, we need to do it based on the most recent research into what's the best way to teach children. And I'm oversimplifying that by quite a bit, but we really do only have an hour, so I have to... I have to make some concessions to that. The research that you're talking about how to get the most out of students or how to reach get closer to our achievement goals, what is that research? What are you talking about? And The follow-up to that, I'll just throw it out there right now. How do we use the school funding mechanisms that states have the ability to put in place in order to get at that?
That's an excellent observation. Typically, what the research that I'm writing about in this particular paper is aligned across various disciplines. I move from economic research to research on student ability and motivation to organization theory. All these types of research help inform us as researchers and practitioners how to best align our spending for increased student outcomes. A simple example is this. Basic school funding mechanisms tend to have some type of equalization for low-income kids, and they treat all low-income kids as the same. How that low-income kid is measured then becomes the question. Typically, the characteristic is defined by the percentage of children using free and reduced price lunch. It's in legislation all across the country. If you talk to most researchers, most will say that that is an inaccurate measure to distribute dollars to kids in need, primarily because as kids get older, there's a stigma tied to being classified as a free and reduced lunch kid, and participation decreases. As participation decreases in this particular category, less funding actually goes to the school. A better measure may be the percentage of individuals in the community that don't have a high school diploma. A better indicator may be actual average property wealth in a census district, median family income. There are a whole host of other information that is available that can better measure need in a particular district than the ones we're using now. And unfortunately, to change something like that in a school finance mechanism actually has to get processed through the state legislative system and become law, which of course then becomes highly politicized.
Well, there you've put your finger right on it, though. I mean, schools are about the most political places we have. They've been tremendously politicized over the last 30 years.
Yes, that's correct.
And anybody, well, I'm going to stop right there. My problem here is that my mother-in-law is a retired teacher. My wife and daughter are both teachers in an elementary school. And my grandmother was a teacher. I come from a big family of teachers, so mm-hmm. this is kind of a touchy subject. But you take a look at the fundamental assumptions behind things like No Child Left Behind is that that 100% of the students in any school district are going to be able to be at a certain proficiency level, which is, of course, absurd on its face. There isn't any research that supports that, and it doesn't. It's not even common sense, and yet. Policies like this determine how schools get funded. And, you know, my question here is, how do you break this cycle of education being used as a political football?
I don't think education will ever not be. One of the things I try to emphasize when I speak to folks is, because we've all had some level of education, we all have an opinion on how we think education works best. One of the stories that I tell was when I was working in Washington State, a state legislature stood up and said, "No, when I was a young person, we had these little one-room schoolhouses, and we all turned out just fine. Just look at us." And there was proposed legislation for something called the Little Red Schoolhouse. And it was something that was brought on just because of a comment that was made there by a state legislator. Or something like on a larger scale of No Child Left Behind, measuring outcomes for kids and making them public will then cause school districts to direct resources towards addressing those districts in need. In principle, that sounds like an excellent way to formulate policy. You measure progress and you address deficiencies. Unfortunately, progress in and of itself measured by a standardized test may not be the value that's preferenced in a particular district. And that is not to say that a district does not believe in educational achievement and high educational achievement at that. But some districts have to deal with truancy issues, or some districts may have to deal with a highly mobile population. Some districts may have to deal with extremely low-income residents to such an effect that they have very low parental involvement. So in addressing the achievement issues on the face of this kind of large political issue, these other socioeconomic issues need to be addressed first before achievement can even be addressed.
We have callers who want to join us, and we'll get to that. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll have some other people talk about what they think. And that's always a good thing. We're talking about education, specifically how it's funded, and one of the things I still want to get to is this idea of tailoring school funding to the needs of individual school districts and perhaps making it more localized in terms of who controls the money. And we'll get to that and your calls after we take this short break. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 23 minutes after 9 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up later on today. After 3 on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, Gene Faraca talks with an award-winning children's author about the compelling and uplifting story of African AIDS orphans. That's after 3 o'clock this afternoon. Gene Faraca, Here on Earth. This hour, we're talking about education. I'm joined by R. Anthony Roll, Associate Professor at the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University. He is the author of a report just released by the Great Lakes Center for Research and Practice titled Strengthening the Link Between Effective School Expenditures and State Funding Mechanisms. We have lines available for you. Not all of them are full, and you can call us at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's a local number for you, so please call us at 414-227-2050, 227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Well, I said we were going to go to the phones, and we will. First, I just wanted to go back to something that you were talking about. You know, the we've placed a great deal of emphasis on measuring achievement. The complaint that I hear from teachers is that they end up spending almost as much time on assessment as they do teaching, and that seems like a disproportionate amount of time spent on something that's not directly related to what you do in some ways. You want to comment on that a little bit?
Assessment has long been what I would call the harbinger of education. Even in the late 1800s, I use a quote when I'm speaking that says, you know, we have to be wary of the tyranny of testing, because as we test more and more, students will be less and less able to use their creative minds as opposed to focusing on this particular assessment. As assessment is related to funding, it actually may be the tail that's wagging the dog. There's been several pushes for outcome-based funding or incentive structures based on certain types of outcomes. If funding shifts in this particular direction, there will be a continued increase in the emphasis on more and more assessment.
Well, but teaching to the test is what you end up with.
That's extremely possible, and quite frankly, there are several cases of that being quite likely as well. In retrospect, as all of us who have been in school or who still are participating in the educational process, the end result of education really is not performing well on some standardized exam. It's the ability to be a creative thinker. It's the ability to be a problem solver. It's the ability to use your innate and learned abilities to solve problems. And I'm not sure that standardized testing alone can actually measure those things accurately.
We'll go to the phones and take a call first from Kyle in Madison. Kyle, good morning.
Yes,
thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call this morning. I wanted to ask a little bit about charter schools and What's some of the strengths as you understand them, some of the challenges in terms of how it affects our funding structure in this country and education?
Thanks, Kyle. For those who don't know, charter schools are schools that are designed to be outside of the traditional state bureaucracy and traditional state requirements to give particular districts or schools more flexibility and creativity in how they deliver educational services. And with that, in terms of budgeting and finance, the requirements that are placed on how they spend the money also are relaxed in exchange for more accountability in terms of student outcomes. Given that, charter schools at this point is showing kind of a mixed bag. There are some very successful charter schools that are focusing on middle and low performing children of all types, be they low-income kids or minority kids, rural kids, inner-city kids, and are showing great strides in terms of those students' educational outcomes. But there are also a lot of research results that are showing that charter schools do not show the large gains that they are purported to create. By the same token, adding creativity can only help to improve both public and private education by either testing new ideas or applying old ideas in a new way that show improvement. One particular criticism is that some charter schools are skimming the cream of the intellectual crop from public schools and placing them all in one place and leaving the remainder of students in public schools to suffer. So on balance, the research on charter school at this point still is mixed, though there are some success stories.
Kyle, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Susie in Green Bay. Susie, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
And thank you for taking my call. I have to tell you, I'm a member of one of those families with hundreds of years of teaching experience and many teachers in the immediate family. And I have to tell you, I can't disagree more with the statement that the host made with regarding proficiency levels and students, that it's not realistic for us to describe proficiency levels for our students in public schools in this country. I think it's relatively easy to define a proficiency level in reading and mathematics that is mandatory for citizenship. You need a certain grade level of competence in order to read a newspaper, to manage your personal finances. I think it's relatively easy. I think maybe what we ought to be looking at here in education is that No Child Left Behind is the right concept, but perhaps we have errant application in that what we are testing is too broad. We are testing too much of the curriculum within the framework of No Child Left Behind. By the way, the latest brain-based research on how the human brain works tells us that teaching to the test is exactly what we should be doing, that the creative thinking skills that the guest is referring to is built on top of those basic skills. I think that our issue right now is we are not focusing on making sure that our students are proficient at the basic skills so that they can go higher up onto the Bloom's taxonomy with regard to their ability to function in an academic realm. And I'm on the road, so I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Susie, thanks for the call. Professor?
I think Susie's comment about proficiency is a good one, but it is one that actually begs the question of the test. There is no doubt that we should be requiring students to be proficient. I'm actually one that believes that we should be pushing all students to be beyond proficient, to be excellent at whatever their academic strengths are. But she is absolutely correct that NCLLB is applied differently in every state in the country. In every state in the country, because each state is allowed to set their own standard for proficiency. So a high-performing student in California may not be a high-performing student in Mississippi. A high-performing student in New Mexico may not be a high-performing student in New York City. And it may be that the standards which we are testing are too broad. In other countries such as Germany and Japan, they actually have very strong testing systems. In fact, you have to test to move between certain levels of schooling, but they actually test for deeper knowledge in fewer subjects. So Susie may be onto something.
Well, I wasn't saying that you can't have proficiency standards. My point was that the idea that you would get 100% of the students in any class to the levels that we're talking about defies logic. You're always going to have some students, no matter how good the teacher is, who just aren't going to get it, because students come in to the classroom with different sets of abilities, different levels of intelligence. And since we've made the decision in this country to throw everybody together into the same classroom, regardless of ability, you're always going to have some students who are going to be behind others. I mean, it just seems to me that that's one and one or two. You can't really get away from that.
I am one who agrees. I think the comment that you made and the comment that Susie made are slightly different. I think Susie was referring to setting a level of basic proficiency, and your comment, John, was even after we set this level, will everybody make it?
That's the question I'm asking. It doesn't seem to me that it's possible to do that. But I'm often wrong, but never uncertain.
I don't believe it's possible for every child to learn everything that we want them to learn. It is almost a stand against individualism. And what I mean is there are some folks that are excellent at physics, and there are some folks that are excellent at English literature. Very few students are excellent at both. And unfortunately, we have some that aren't good at either. So with all of the work that students can put in, with all the work that their parents can put in, with community support and an aligned educational curriculum, I think you're correct. Some students aren't going to make it. I think that percentage is a small one.
And some students are better at taking tests than others as well.
Absolutely. And I also think that we need to move beyond a focus of testing as an academic outcome. I do believe that students have to perform no matter what, but students have, in some states, 180 days, some states 210 days of education that's based on a daily basis. If the criteria or standard for a particular assessment is still on some type of standardization that's placed by the state or by NCLB, I think that's fine, but teachers can exercise their sense of professionalism in assessing whether or not a child has reached a particular standard.
We're going to take some more.
That standard may be beyond what is measured simply on an assessment.
Okay, we're going to take some more phone calls, but I want to try and get the discussion back on to the main question here, which is where we started from, and that is your contention in this report is that one of the problems we have is that we're not applying the money that we have to put into K-12 education in the right way. And I would like to get back to how do we fix that problem, what needs to be done, and give me an example of what you would consider to be an ideal situation in terms of how a state might handle the apportionment of what is admittedly a finite resource, the dollars we put into K-12 education. In an ideal world, how would that happen? How should that happen from your perspective?
In an ideal world, I'm going to just take your comment to the absurd, that we could measure every child individually, assess them, and say, this is how we're going to spend money for this particular child. Well, of course, that's impossible because we don't have limitless amounts of resources. But what we can do is look at particular schools and look at particular districts and assess their needs, and we may find that one particular district needs assistance in reading, or another particular district may need assistance in mathematics, and then tailor that spending according to the needs of the district. How we have funding mechanisms now, primarily they are input-based. If you have a certain percentage of student type A, you get this dollar amount. If you have a certain percentage of student type B, you get this dollar amount, and so on down the line. If we start changing the focus to what student needs are based on the policy outcomes that that school districts and the legislators want and fund the need accordingly, then I think we're taking positive steps. State mechanisms now really are designed to facilitate probably the middle 80%, if I'm making a general statement, of students. And then exceptions are made for those districts at the extreme top and extreme bottom based on particular circumstances. Ultimately, as these dollars move from the state down to the district, increased budgetary flexibility also will aid in this funding specialization that's going to be necessary for districts to achieve desired outcomes. And when I refer to budgetary flexibility, just because a dollar comes down for a particular category, if the superintendent and school principals note that there is a specific need that is not being addressed, they should be able to spend money out of category in order to address that need. Some states have highly flexible spending criteria, and other states do not.
We will go back to the phones, and let's go to Joseph in La Crosse next. Joseph, good morning.
Good morning. First of all, thank you for the show, and I couldn't agree more with the bulk of what your guest has to say and your comments as well. One thing that I think we sometimes lose track of is what's the point to education? And if I may, I'd like to share very quickly something that Rudolf Steiner said a number of years ago. One should not ask, what does the person need to know or to be able to do for the existing social order, but rather, what gifts does the person possess, and how may these be developed in him or her? Then it will be possible to bring the social order ever new forces from each generation. That way the social order will be alive with what each fully developed individual brings with him or her, rather than that each succeeding generation is made to conform to the existing social organization. I think that's missing from our education debate. Why are we even testing children in the second and third grade? I have five children. One of them started reading when he was 2.5 years old, and one of them started reading when he was 6. We're talking about more school, pre-K, 3-K. The Finns have the greatest educational system on the planet. They don't start school for their kids until they're 7 years old. Why do we keep trying to think that, you know, we have these absolute minimums that 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds have to be able to achieve? So many children are different from so many other children.
Joseph, you've actually touched on kind of the underlying theme in this particular piece, is that we are engaged in an educational process that's really based out of the industrial age in the early 1920s, where the educational process really was focused on those students that were performing or could perform in the top 20% in terms of their academic achievement. Over time, of course, as the economy has changed, more and more individuals now need that education. In the past, the top 20% was designed to get educated, start businesses, or go work in existing businesses, and come back and employ the other 80%. With globalization, with the rise of the internet, with the rise of the information age, as well as now jobs actually requiring more knowledge, more analytical skills, and more creativity, the focus now really is shifting from that top 20% and how well they're educated, and needs to focus on that bottom 80% and how well they're educated, and how we are going to take this 80% of our current student body and make them productive members as globalism and the information age continues to blossom.
Joseph, thanks for that call. We're going to go next to Ernest from Hayward.
Oh, am I on?
Good morning. Go ahead.
Okay. How about allocating funding to the family of the student on a sliding scale? Income is very easy to measure, and you'd be assisting the family rather than the school district, and that is about as local as you can get.
I believe you're hinting at structuring some type of a voucher program. Voucherizing education also is becoming more and more popular. For those who don't know what a voucher is, it actually is a direct funding to a family at a certain amount so that family can buy the educational services that are most appropriate for the children in that particular family based on the parental desire. And it really then begins to set up a type of pseudo market where parents can buy educational services that they need. In the course of buying these services, some schools will prosper, some schools will fail. Again, the research on voucherized education is also somewhat of a mixed bag. Some voucher programs are strong, some voucher programs are weak. And, of course, in Wisconsin, you all have lots of data and information on the Milwaukee plan, so I won't belabor that point.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question about that. Isn't the fundamental assumption underlying the whole voucher philosophy is that education is somehow a commodity that can be bought and bought and sold, and that the market is the best determiner of success? Do you think that is that it?
The underlying principle, yes, that is critical. It's ensconced in a term or a concept that's called liberty, the ability to choose and make the decisions with the amount of information you have. And with this ability to choose, a market system will emerge. Unfortunately, I'm one who believes that analysis is incorrect. As long as government provides the subsidy, a true market will never emerge. A true market is based on free exchange. So if a voucher is given to you, John, and I, but you happen to have an extra $10,000, we're not competing on a purely exchange market. We're competing on a subsidized market, meaning the amount of education that you spend can be $10,000 greater than the amount of education that I can spend on. And in this particular market or quasi-market that's set up, you can buy $10,000 worth of improved or better services than I can. So the same type of skimming of effect or stratification is going to be replicated that already exists in society.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll have some more callers who want to chime in on this topic. We're talking in general terms about the relationship between school funding and student achievement. And we'll continue that discussion in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9:46. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, it's no joke. Next hour, we're going to be talking about the history and philosophy of jokes. So did you hear the one about a priest, a rabbi, and a minister walk into a bar? The bartender says, "What is this, a joke?" Well, they'll be better than that after the news at 10 o'clock, I promise. Or maybe not. This hour, we're talking about education and the relationship between student achievement and the way dollars are allocated in the states. We have some lines available for you if you would like to call in and join our discussion, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050. My guest is R. Anthony Roll, Associate Professor at the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University. He is the author of a report just released by the Great Lakes Center for Research and Practice titled Strengthening the Link Between Effective School Expenditures and State Funding Mechanisms. We'll take David in Ironwood, Michigan next.
Hello.
David, good morning.
One thing I want to point out with the school vouchers is that they could, I mean, a group of like-minded people could then reinforce their ideas onto the kids. I think society has a public right to have a public education to pass on societal values, you know, Americans' values of freedom, democracy, and all this stuff. And your other guests that called earlier made real good points about not having the rich be able to just buy 10 times better education, because we need to get everyone. I like the other caller saying trying to develop the potential of all the people out there. You know, the next heart surgeon might be the little kid in the ghetto if he's given the right education. And it's also, people have to realize that some, you know, if school district didn't do well, what if it's had a lot of people who are maybe MR, dyslexic, learning disabilities? They're going to have a lot harder time teaching those kids than a school district where, you know, they didn't have any problems. Maybe one school district have a lot of pollution that caused a lot of dyslexic people in their district, where the other school district had, you know, in clean, pristine environment and upper middle class to get good outcomes, you know. So it's easy to teach a kid who's has all the mental faculties there, whereas some of the people with learning disabilities, with emotional problems and all this stuff, you know, to penalize these schools because they can't raise their grades, you know, is not a level playing field.
David, thanks for the call. Professor?
Let's not forget that the purpose of state funding mechanisms is to fund districts in inverse proportion to their ability to raise money. So the poorest districts tend to receive the most amount of state aid. And the real question then begins, how much more can the local district spend above what the state minimum requirement is? David is extremely correct in that we need to be more cognizant about what types of kids are receiving what types of information and what types of education. And in a perfect world, every child will have the same ability to access services and resources that are being provided by the state. One of the reasons that I wrote this paper was to call on folks to examine spending in their particular state to make sure that this type of equal access or adequate education is being provided for all kids.
800-486-8655 and 227-2050 are the numbers to call. We are going to try and get as many callers as we can into the program. Let's go next to Martha in Dubuque, Iowa. Martha, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. As the previous caller was talking about, you know, and just being here listening to this, isn't the state funding kind of a trickle-down effect from federal funding? I guess that's one of my questions for your guest. And in effect, that the trickle-down effect, the states do not have the particular funding that maybe that they feel is needed, that they need more funding. And also, with No Child Left Behind, if schools do not meet the criteria, they are penalized, and their funding is taken away if I'm educated correctly. And your guests can speak to that as well and help me learn a little bit more about it. But I just think No Child Left Behind, the mandate, needs to be scrapped. I just think it needs to be totally scrapped, because children learn differently, and we need to look at how we can help those children before they get to school, and we also need to help our parents and our families what they can do at home. And I think it's a societal issue where the funding isn't there. It's not helping those people who are having children who are not coming prepared to school. And in essence, it's affecting those children when they take those tests. And what I mean by societal issues, I mean, you know, health care. I'm talking about single parents who are trying to work and yet they're struggling because they need to pay for child care. I'm talking about children who may not have the parents and those parenting skills at home. I just think it's a societal issue when we have children in school, and yet we can spend billions and billions of dollars, on war. It just really bothers me, and I think we need to take a whole look at how we are funding those programs that make our society a better place for us to raise our children.
Martha, thank you for calling.
Martha raises two very interesting education finance questions. The first of which is, in essence, where does the money come from? Primarily, money comes from state, local, and federal sources in some combination. Now, the interesting part of her question is her belief that the federal portion is the largest. By far and away, the federal portion of state spending is the smallest. Nationally, the federal government contributes about 10% to education. The other 90% comes from state and local sources in some combinations. And depending upon which state you live in, the local portion that is being contributed may be higher than the state portion, or vice versa. But given that the federal government only contributes 10% to education, the amount of influence that no child left behind is considered by some to be disproportionate. The other question that Martha raised was, in the context of no child left behind, is that schools that don't meet certain performance standards are penalized in terms of having their funding reduced. I'm no expert on no child left behind, but typically, from the sources that I've read and the folks that I've discussed this with, only the federal portion of funding can be reduced, meaning of the 100% of dollars spent on education, only the 10% portion nationwide, in rough terms, can be reduced.
We'll go next to, let's see, how about Pat in Winneconne?
Hello there.
Hi, Pat. Good morning.
I am very happy to hear this subject on the radio. I live in a small town in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has capped their schools at the 1992 spending level. Our community gets $8,000 per student, and yet our test scores on some points are 29 points higher than a neighboring school district. Our test scores are the highest in the region. Other schools get $15,000 to $17,000 per student. We have cut and cut and cut in our school district. We have no aides in the classroom. We have very few extracurriculars. They're cutting down to one librarian for the entire school district. We keep going to referendum to supplement the amount of money the state gives us. Because of the economy, our referendum keeps failing. The school keeps cutting, and yet our test scores are so high. I'd like to know why we're not rewarded for good test scores, because as we cut, our test scores are going to start falling. We're going to have to increase class sizes and cut out essentials, basically, that are going to affect our children. And I think it's very unfair that some school districts would get $15,000 to $17,000 per student, and yet we have the much higher test scores, and we're only getting $8,000 per student.
Pat, thanks for that. We only have about a minute left, Professor.
Oh, well, Pat actually has posed a question that will take more than a minute, but I'll do my best. In essence, Pat is questioning how equity is defined in the state of Wisconsin. Typically, equity is defined in terms of inputs. If you have this type, if you have a certain type of needy student, you receive extra funding. What Pat is asking is, well, if we are performing better, maybe the definition of equity should be those who have high performances should get more of the pie. In essence, she is arguing that as her schools in her district continue to perform well and dollars get cut, that the current redistribution of dollars is actually going to adversely affect their test scores, and that is not fair. In essence, I think Pat did a good job of summing up the basic school finance debate.
Well, Professor, this has been a very, very interesting hour, and I want to thank you for joining us and all of our callers as well. Well, I think we've all gotten a little bit of an education this morning, and that's, after all, why we're here. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Our Anthony Roll, Associate Professor at the College of Education and Human Development at Texas A&M University. He is the author of a report just released by the Great Lakes Center for Research and Practice titled Strengthening the Link Between Effective School Expenditures and State Funding Mechanisms. And you can find a copy of that report online at greatlakescenter.org. This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning. John Anderson answered the phones for us today, and thank you to them for all of their great help. I'm John Munson. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math. You study them hard and hoping to pass.